Money Radio. Thank you for joining us, and it is a pleasure now to welcome Dr. William Janeway. He has a distinguished career, including senior advisor and managing director of Warburg Pincus. He is also involved as director of Magnet Systems and O'Reilly Media, and he is an author, and he wrote Doing Capitalism in the Innovation Economy, which has now moved into its second edition, fully revised and updated. Doing Capitalism in the Innovation Economy, Reconfiguring the Three-Player Game Between Markets, Speculators, and the State. Dr. Janeway, thank you so much for joining us today.
Delighted to be with you.
First off, let's explain the three-player game. And who is involved and why is it important when we're talking about the innovation economy?
Very good. Great place to start. So in 1970, a long time ago, I left academia after I got my doctorate in economics and discovered over the next 10 years that I'd become a venture capitalist. Through the 1980s, 90s, and into the great internet bubble at the end of the last century, I realized that investing in computers and software and the internet, that I was actually dancing on a platform that had been constructed by the United States government, specifically by the United States Department of Defense, which had funded all of the components from silicon to software that combined to make up the digital revolution, and then all of that, including the internet, of course, was hugely amplified and accelerated by the great financial speculation of the 1990s. So I began to think about the world of innovation, of economic development through technological innovation, as a kind of game being played between the government, the state, when it had a politically legitimate mission, and of course, in the case of this digital revolution, that mission was the Cold War, and on the other hand, financial speculators always looking to exploit and take advantage of discontinuities, disruptions in the world around them. Most of the time, when they generate bubbles, they leave no productive, positive economic assets behind. But occasionally, the railways, electrification, and of course now the internet, they leave an enormous amount of extremely productive infrastructure, and they also fund the exploration of what this new stuff is good for, the Amazons and Googles that now absolutely define the world we live in as consumers and explorers. So this intersection between mission-driven state and financial speculation impacts on the third player, the market economy, the world of work and consumption and spending, the ordinary day-to-day work of economic living. So I think of this three-player game as playing out between the government, the state, the political process, the financial markets, speculators, and the market economy, which is disrupted and driven and evolves in response to the first two.
This disruption often manifests itself in a bubble, a crash in the financial system. That spills over and it affects the markets, it affects the states, it affects everyone.
Absolutely correct. And that's why I distinguish between different financial bubbles, and they occur everywhere. Wherever there's a market in assets, whether it's tulip bulbs or houses or bitcoins, or for that matter, new promising technologically driven companies in infotech or biotech, wherever there are markets and assets, there will be speculation, there will be bubbles. Now, you can distinguish those bubbles along two different dimensions. One, is the target of the speculation an asset which actually can contribute to increasing the productivity and the living standards of the people in the economy? or is it just trading assets back and forth, which have no fundamental contribution to make? And second, is the speculation limited to the public capital markets where there's relatively very little borrowing, or does it infect the banking system, the credit system, as it did in 2007 when that enormous credit bubble, when it burst, it froze the world economy and left behind beach houses rotting away, never occupied, never completed. Whereas the internet bubble was limited to the stock market and the junk bond market. When it burst, it was within limits that were easily contained by the central banks of the world, by the Federal Reserve, and it left behind the essential components of a new digital economy. That's how I distinguish between the two kinds of bubbles.
And that's a good description of the destructive power that was seen in 2008 as well as back in roughly 1928.
Absolutely. Exactly right. Exactly right. When, again, the credit bubble of the 1920s infected the banking system, and it took 3 years, but it led to the closing of all the banks in the United States to try to cleanse the system and be able to start recovery after a much worse condition than we experienced in 2009.
But in 2008, 2009, following that, we never really did go through that cleansing.
Well, you know, that's a very good point. And, you know, both economists and historians, I think, have missed a central part of the story. And it's very simply defined in terms of numbers. In 1929, the total public sector of the United States was 7%. 2% was in the federal government. 5% were state and local governments, which were constrained by their constitutions to balance the budget. They had to cut spending when their tax revenues fell, and the federal government was much too small to offset the terrifying contraction in the private sector when private investment declined literally by 100%. There was no private investment in 1932. This time around, the public sector in the U.S. is on the order, was in 2007 and is today on the order of about a total of 35%. Much bigger and consequently able to buffer the contraction in the private sector so that this time we peaked out at 10 to 12% unemployment, which is terrible, but nothing like the 25% unemployment that we had in the Great Depression. So the role, like it or not, the role of big government, even without deliberate policy moves such as the Obama stimulus bill, which did play a constructive role in offsetting the private sector contraction. But this time around, the public sector was big enough to offset and save the private sector from itself.
This brings up a very interesting point, though. In this three-player game between the market, speculators, and the state, inevitably it would seem that there is going to be one player that gains power, and don't they then have the ability to influence the other players in the game?
They certainly do.
And perhaps not in always a positive manner.
They certainly do, and you can see it both ways. You can see those with political power looking to assert themselves in the markets of the economy and the financial system, but vice versa. And one of the major motivations for revisiting the subject matter of my book, and when I say the reconfiguration of the three-player game, was the following. Back in the 50s, 60s, and in through the 1970s, it was the federal government which had a legitimate mission to invest upstream way before any venture capitalists, let alone public market investors like pension funds and university endowments, could have dreamed of investing in the seed corn from the computer science to the working computers that, as I say, created this new economy. It took the government, the mission-driven state, to do that. Over the last generation, and despite the role of the public sector in protecting the private sector from itself in 2009, the federal government in the United States has distinctively been made illegitimate as an economic actor. It is not available for the same kind of upstream investing in science and the exploration of the technology derived from the science to, for example, particularly in this country, in the United States, for the state, for the Department of Energy to be investing in the same kind of upstream research and development that we desperately need in response to climate change. I think that the abdication of the United States from the green revolution, the next new economy that could create enormous numbers of jobs in reconstructing and making our physical infrastructure of transportation and housing radically less carbon intensive. We are missing that opportunity. And I'll tell you who is not missing that opportunity. It's China. China is making the kind of commitments that suggest that at the next frontier, the frontier of green, clean technologies, China will play the role that the U.S. did in all of the digital technologies.
It would make a lot of sense as part of this green revolution to see the federal government play a more proactive role. That is not happening, though, and as you say, China is doing it. Others are doing it.
Right.
What is going to be the result of that? Are we about to see a massive change in the geopolitical landscape?
I think it is possible. It is possible. Perhaps not myself, given the fact that I'm in my eighth decade, but my children, our children, are very likely to see, at least in part, only the second succession in technological leadership in world history. The U.S. continues to be, by and large, at the frontier of private sector exploration of what to do with all this digital technology that was spawned by the federal government. But we are woefully behind and with very limited commitments to the energy storage technologies, the smart grid management, as well as the kind of nuts and bolts or pitchfork and shovel work that will help us adapt to as well as survive what is now clearly on the way. You don't need to be ideological about this. All you have to do is go visit what used to be called Glacier National Park or watch the way the flowers bloom each year earlier and earlier as you move through the Northeast and the Midwest and the Far West to recognize that something's going on here and we're being woefully and painfully blind to its implications for how we live and what it costs us to live. Of course, in the meantime, we've got gasoline going back up to the level at which it will force some savings, but it'll force it most on the people who can least afford to adjust to it.
You bring up some incredible points in the book, and I want to dig into the idea of where we are in the digital revolution and how advances may help us move into the green revolution. But first, we'll take a quick break and remind folks that we're talking with Dr. William Janeway, and the book is Doing Capitalism in the Innovation Economy, Reconfiguring the Three-Player Game Between Markets, Speculators, and the State. Doing Capitalism in the Innovation Economy. This is the second edition. It has been revised. It has been updated. And it is now available. The second edition is now available. And this is a very important work. A lot of people have referred to this as a classic. And that's probably an apt description. We will continue with Dr. William Janeway in just a moment. Thank you so much for joining us. Our guest, Dr. William Janeway, the book, Doing Capitalism in the Innovation Economy. And it's just such an important book. It deals with so much. Let's talk about where we are in the digital revolution. That is going to be what leads us into the green revolution.
Well, that's right. Again, a second powerful motivation for going back and revisiting all of the matter that I was first, that I lived for 40 years as a working venture capitalist at the technological frontier. Reason for going back in good part was because over the last 5 years, it's become clear that the digital revolution has matured to a point where it doesn't need state support or subsidy anymore. In fact, at multiple levels, it's attacking the authority of the state. It was IT, information technology, that enabled outsourcing, that radically increased the flow of trade in both goods and services, that integrated the global financial markets so we could have a financial crisis, such as we had in 2008. And at the micro level, at the local level, you've got these innovators, these disruptive innovators like Uber and Airbnb, that are challenging the whole ecosystem of rules and regulations around local transportation, around accommodation. And not all of those rules were put in to protect the profits of people who own taxicab medallions like Michael Cohen. They were there in part for safety, and they arose out of lived experience. So we've got huge challenges in thinking just how the public sector interacts with these disruptions in the markets of the private sector so that the cost isn't borne entirely and exclusively by the working people whose lives are being turned upside down. That's the second real motivation for going back to this book and producing this very substantially revised and updated edition. Beyond that, there's no doubt that right at the frontier, the kind of new machine learning, the rebirth of what is called artificial intelligence, although we're a long way from having to worry about, you know, either the Terminator or HAL in 2001. But nonetheless, the kinds of predictive analytics based on all of this data being generated and captured on the internet can help us manage down the consumption of carbon and manage up the productivity and efficiency of the economy so that we can maintain living standards while we adjust to the new green world.
Yeah, but here's a bit of a rub. Digital technology has been, and the explosion of that, has been an unevenly distributed technology. Some people have a lot of data, some people have very little technology.
Right.
That will also affect how we move forward for green.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. And we should, this has happened before. When electrification, which sort of goes back to the 1880s, 1870s and 1880s, it took 50 years. It took 50 years to build out the infrastructure so that whether you were a guy with a small machine shop or a big company with factories or someone at home who wanted to take advantage and use an automatic washing machine instead of a scrub board, it took 50 years before you could just plug it in, and the technology became democratic. It's beginning to become democratic now as we see the cloud service providers making it possible to get access on a much cheaper basis and much easier to manage basis to computing and storage and even the kind of data analysis that only the big companies can afford to invest in today. Mm-hmm. That is going to take a generation, though, to really spill over and make it a much more level playing field.
This is an incredible book, Doing Capitalism in the Innovation Economy. Dr. William Janeway just absolutely nailed it with this book, and it should be part of your library. Doing Capitalism in the Innovation Economy, second edition, fully revised, all updated. Get a copy of it. Dr. Janeway, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.